Hello to all of you boys next door, mums and dads, new weds and nearly deads, and welcome to Dangerous Amusements, a podcast where we talk about the music of Elvis Costello. I'm Stu Arrowsmith, and on each episode I'm joined by a special guest to chat all things Elvis, and I ask them to help me compile the ultimate Elvis Costello playlist. Don't make any sudden movements, because these are Dangerous Amusements. In this episode, my guest is a writer and the author of terrific music books on the Beatles, John Lennon and Bob Dylan, among others. Welcome to Dangerous Amusements, Tim Riley.
Hey, nice to be here.
It's lovely to have you on. How are you?
I'm good. We're good this morning. I'm in Boston and it's overcast and cold. It's a bit of British weather we're having here.
We like to leave a little bit of legacy in these places that we used to run, you see. It's normally the weather, I think. Oh, great stuff. Well, people listening in will know you from your music writing and your great books, which you'll talk about shortly. But you teach music as well, don't you?
Yeah, so my position is called Associate Professor of Journalism at Emerson College. And what we teach there is called digital journalism. So I teach a lot of different kinds of journalism. And the two courses I'm teaching right now are a course on the Independent Magazine, which is about covering independent film when the students publish their own magazine. And also a course called Cultural Criticism, which covers a range of different types of critics in different platforms. And in the spring, I'll teach music criticism, which I organize as kind of a history of rock and roll as a way of getting student ears acquainted with, how we arrive at the sounds that we have today through rock and roll history. And that I'm also working on the Riley Rock Report, which was my newsletter, Substack.
Yeah, great. And as well as your interest in rock and roll and the history of it, some of your earliest influences would have been in classical, would they?
Yeah, so I started out as a classical pianist. As a teenager, I fell in love with the classical repertoire. I was playing piano, and I sort of had these dual passions. I was learning, Bach inventions and preludes and fugues and Beethoven sonatas on the piano. And then I was always listening to rock and roll. I had a really big thing for rock and roll, but I also heard Leonard Bernstein's Norton lectures. I remember watching those as a kid and just being really enthralled with all the ideas that he was talking about, musical metaphor and all of that stuff I was hearing in classical music. I remember thinking, how come it's all in rock and roll too? Like all this stuff I'm learning about classical, like there's a lot of that, it helps you appreciate rock and roll. And so I went off to music school and I majored in piano at a conservatory. And I taught this course on the side about the Beatles. And I just pursued both of those things pretty strongly. And what I tell my Emerson students is that it's very hard to remember now. It's a good thing, but it really has faded a lot. There used to be very severe distinctions between high culture and low culture. And, a classical musician was not supposed to dabble in rock and roll. That was like, that's not your lane. And I definitely had friends who I was studying classical music with who thought I was a little bit nutty for listening to rock and roll. Like, what do you hear in that? And I had rock and roll friends who were like, they just couldn't process that I was also a classical pianist. That didn't make any sense to them. And to me, there just seems like a false choice. Like, why do you have to, like, especially in America, like, isn't that the whole idea that we're egalitarian, that there's many different kinds of things and that a style doesn't have to be so class-based? And I still feel that way, but a lot of those distinctions have faded. I think that's one of the big accomplishments that the Beatles, part of the Beatles' triumph is that they behaved so persuasively that rock and roll could be invested with an artistic sensibility and could have many different aesthetic layers and be poetic in that sense. And so that's sort of been my mission. I still love classical music and I write about it a lot and I'm still engaged with it. But my primary profile as a professional has been as a Beatle expert. And that's really interesting how that has changed over the years, right? I'll speak at academic conferences on the Beatles and there's the crew that goes to those conferences has been expanding, over the years a lot. So academia, I like to think of it, academia slowly catching up with oral culture.
Well, the man whose music we're talking about today is someone who has, you know, crossed different genres and boundaries, or perhaps doesn't see boundaries in his music. When did Elvis Costello come into the picture for you as a fan?
Okay, so this will date me, but I hope it's useful. So Miami's True came out when I was a senior in high school. So that was a pretty heady, that was a pretty heady season, right? So we had the Ramones and the Talking Heads and the Clash and Elvis Costello. And there were, to my ear, there were two large camps, right? One was punk, Sex Pistols. And I remember listening to the Sex Pistols for the first time. I remember listening to Clash. I love the song title, I'm So Bored with the USA. And I remember listening to it thinking, this is perfect. This is it. As an American, I embrace this. And so there was punk, and then there was this other area that was new wave. And both of them were really, I don't like the titles for either of them, but they were pretty distinct in my mind. So Elvis Costello's My Aim Is True had, you know, it had touches of punk energy, but it wasn't really a punk record. But you could also tell that he was different than punk, and that he really did bring a historical sensibility to the music. And he was really quite interested in the legacy, in the threads that led back. And then you'd hear on his B-sides, he'd be singing Burt Bacharach, I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself. And, you know, so as a kid, Costello was really a wonderful teacher, a wonderful musicologist, to sort of start to hear a lot of these influences and roots in a new way. And, you know, the Almost Blue record was very, very, I really loved that record. I was really upset when I saw critics taking that record apart, because for me, it was the introduction. I mean, you know, I went and got George Jones, and I went and got Tammy Wynette. And I was one of these people who was like, yeah, you have to adjust to the voice. The voice is maybe not a problem, but it's distinctive. It's like, it's not for everybody. You have to sort of listen through the voice maybe somewhat. But, you know, I was already a big Dylan fan, and this was like, well, it's an unusual voice. Big deal. For me, it was what he was investing in the voice. It was his conviction, his passion, his he was not phoning it in. So, I mean, and that really matters, right, to kids. And he was pretty central to my listening habits for a good long time. And now, as an older person, he's somebody that I reflect on with a lot of affection and a lot of, you know, he really introduced me to a lot of different ideas. I keep changing my mind about him. But he's, you know, he's had this terrible dilemma that the writers of that generation have had, which is, how do you assemble a 6-decade career? You know, when we first heard My Aim Is True, that was unthinkable that we would be listening to him in 60 years, right? But My Aim Is True was really quite sparkly. You know, it just had, like, you could hear that this guy had thrown away 100 good songs before breakfast, and that he was going to be a songwriter to pay attention to, because these songs were just all over the place. And they were, I really always loved Grill Marcus's coinage for that record was his key themes were revenge and guilt. And, you know, he just milked so much from those ideas. And, you know, I was listening to it again the other day to prepare, and it's still a really good record. It's the band that's weak on that record. And they're, you know, they're just like a thrown together. They're just like, oh, we need to get this guy on record. We're going to throw a group in there and him, and he's going to lead them through. And that sense of urgency and ambition and spontaneity and the sense of the moment is still very strong in the record. And I know that's what they're going for. I wish it just was 10% more energy. There's just something about how it doesn't quite go over the top enough for me.
Yeah, you want the attractions there.
Yes. And, you know, this is a career that we watched quite closely, right? So we're all waiting for his second record. And the second record really delivered, both in terms of that sound, which had much more impact. The production levels were that much greater. And it's not like, oh, I wish the first record had better production levels. But you could tell that he was like, he's getting serious, like he's going to really be a pro about this. And that was all really a good sign. And with the third record, you could see, oh, he had really great production ambition. Like he wants every record to sound different. He's bringing lots of ideas to the soundscape. So yeah, that was all, you know, that was all very promising. We had sort of a new hero that we could watch and come of age with. And that proves to be in the pop world, that's a really big, important hook for young people to grab onto, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's stay in this time period then, because you've chosen some of your favorite Costello songs for us. These are to go on the playlist for this season of the podcast, Powder and Perfume. The rules, as I'm sure everyone knows by now, are that you need to pick six tracks, one from each decade between the 1970s and the 2020s. Your first choice from the 1970s, and from My Aim Is True, this is The Angels Wanna Wear My Red Shoes.
Right. So I chose this because I love the humor in this song. I love the energy of the song, and I love the humor. And of course, we're knocking about as teenagers going, all right, so what does it mean, you know? And nobody can figure out what it means. It's this wonderfully outré, it's very Dylan-esque, right? But it's Dylan-esque in a way that has a sort of a singular flair. It's not something that Dylan wouldn't write about angels in red shoes. So you have this really unique sort of take on a, you know, it's a great tagline, but it's very outré. It's like, yeah, it doesn't add up. And there's other songs that have that sort of mysterious twist in the record, like Mystery Dance, but Mystery Dance is pretty easy to parse, right? It's like, yeah, it's first time is really weird for everybody, but Angels Want to Wear My Red Shoes, what's my side of the bargain? And, you know, it's like, we can't make head or tail of it. And yet the song just soars. It swells. It has this great feel about it. It feels like, oh, there's no other way this melody, this arrangement, these lyrics, there's no other way these things can fit together. This is just a perfect combination of all these different elements. And maybe it's just wonderful on its own without making sense. You know, it had that wonderful kind of spin to it, right? You can't unparse the spin. The spin is like just inimitable. And did I know Nick Lowe by that point? I don't think I did, but very quickly you sort of learn, oh, there's this Nick Lowe guy and there's this whole crew over at Stiff Records. And I really quickly got into Nick Lowe, and Nick Lowe became equally important in that Jesus of Cool, and how they didn't release it as Jesus of Cool in America. We just loved, like, yeah, we're too uptight to publish that as Jesus of Cool, right? But, and then learning about this really great collaboration and a working team between Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe, and Jesus of Lust was really a great one too. I could spend, you know, I could pick six Elvis Costello tunes from the 70s and the 80s. So we'd have 12 tunes in that first two decades. That's how sort of attached I am to the first two decades too. But Angels Want to Wear My Red Shoes really struck me as an early high point. Definitely an early high point. Should have been a single. Should have been a smash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, released as a single over here in the UK, but didn't.
Oh, was
chart.
It really?
Yeah.
Yeah, not and over here.
No, and then on My Aim Is True in July 77, as you mentioned earlier, recorded with Clovis, so and that's John McPhee, Sean Hopper, John Ciambotti, Mickey Shine, and Nick Lowe on backing vocals, as well as producing the record as well, recorded in Pathway Studios. And when was the first time you got to see Elvis live?
So I did see him in the fall of 1978, and he came through Phoenix, Arizona, where I was a freshman in college. And I remember the club was very small. And I also remember the Rubinoos opened. The Rubinoos were really great. I was a big Rubinoos fan. I'm a big power pop guy. And the Rubinoos played I Want to Hold Your Hand that night. And that really stayed with me because it was like the punk version of I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Right.
And that had a lot of punch to it. And Elvis came out and played like what we were hearing. You know, we were following him really closely, and he came out and played like 35 really hard minutes. And we were like, yep, that's exactly how that show should go. We don't want an hour of him. We want 35 minutes that nobody else could do. Like, they were white hot. They were really. So there were people who were like, ugh, 35 minutes, that's it's a ripoff. And we're like, no, it's not a ripoff, because there's more going on in those 35 minutes than most other acts can do in 2 hours. And I had seen Bruce Springsteen by that point. So I had, I know, I sort of knew this, the scale. I knew the space by that point, and I still thought it was really pretty extraordinary 35 minutes. He was in and out really quickly, and then they turned on like some really loud music to get us out. I don't even think there was a second show. It was like, this is over, go home. Anyway, that was the first show I saw. And I remember being like, yep, this is the guy. This is totally the guy. He's got, you know, he's doing it right.
So were you getting more out of the live sound than you'd got from the record of My
Yes,
Name
definitely.
Is True?
Right, definitely. And when they finally released El Macambo, that was like, yeah, that's the sound. That's what I want. It was great to see him. He was doing lots of interviews. He was very talkative. You could, you know, you just really like, this was the guy, right? He was guy. He talked like Pete Townsend, like he understood rock and roll. He had ideas. He was writing these great songs. And when you heard the second album, you're like, yeah, he's, you know, he's in it for the long haul. This guy is totally, he's going to move right along here. This is going to be great. And, you know, whatever happens to punk, he's going to come out of it. Right. Because punk was how long can this last? This was like, this can't, you know, it's too, I don't know. It's too incandescent. Right. It's going to burn really bright and then it's going to just pop. And that's what happened. So we were all curious about what was going to come out of punk and what was going to last. And he was clearly in that category.
The soldier asked my name. Did I come here very often? But I thought that he was asking me to dance in my old coat and hat, and him in his red bonnet. We'd have made a lovely couple, but we never had the chance. Now you say that you've gotta go, if you must, you must. I suppose that you need the sleep of the just.
So here we go with your second song choice. This is for the category of the 1980s, and from the album King of America, we have Sleep of the Just.
In my mind, there are two early peaks in Elvis's first 10 years. Right. So the first peak for me would be Get Happy. And I had to really, the song of the 80s, I had to pick between Get Happy and King of America, because those two for me are really, Get Happy is, I mean, it's just a very, I mean, I obsessed about that record so much. I just love that record to death. And then King of America is, you know, a really, I mean, it's another defining moment. I mean, it's like we're sort of entering a new chapter of writing, of stature, of ambition. There's new horizons in Elvis Costello's thinking by this point, 86. And it's also a great production breakthrough. So you can hear T-Bone Burnett's clean, you know, you want to say pristine, but not in the bad sense. You know, pristine in this just really good, ripe sense, like he's getting every single nuance captured on tape. And you can hear the room, you can hear the musicians almost looking at each other. I mean, there's just this great sense of ensemble throughout the record. And he's following through on his almost blue impulse and writing his own country rock record. And so Elvis Costello is one of the big reasons that I delved into country. So I had a friend, Jimmy Gutterman, and we used to talk about how if you go deep enough, rock and roll will take you to two different oceans. One ocean is the blues, right? And the other ocean is country and western. And I love the blues, but for me, my head, I'm a country and western. Like that's, for me, that's the well that I keep going back to. So King of America was this argument that, okay, so one of the leading British songwriters of his day can actually write a whole album of American country and western, classic sounding American country and western, and employ the very best LA musicians. His choice of musicians on King of America is just a feat of taste in itself, right? And then he gets them to play these songs, and you know, the irony couldn't be riper, right? I mean, anybody else and you'd say, oh, you're British, you can't sing country and western, you know? And yet he's very, very persuasive, and he brings all these British themes and the British views of America, the British, how the British mythologize America, how the British think about American music, right? And it's all of that stuff is packed into this record, and he poses for that picture on the cover of the record with a crown. I mean, it's just superb. He just hits the note beautifully. It's a great, he rings the bell big time with King of America. Oh my God. King of America and Sleep of the Just. So I listened to it again the other day, and it's a very curious song. It's again, it's Dylan-esque. It is from the female's point of view, unlike many other writers, especially Dylan. I mean, Elvis Costello is part of his ambition could be measured in how he's like writing songs from the female point of view. Like very few rock and rollers do that. And he actually does it well. I think My Little Angel is also from the female point of view, Our Little Angel. And Sleep of the Just is about, you know, it's about the war legacy, the World War II war legacy, and thinking about a young woman who she either has or does not have a one-night stand with a guy, and she actually falls for the guy, and she realizes as she's falling for him that he's a dead man, that he's not coming back. And how she has this premonition, we don't know, but the song is deeply sorrowful, deeply full of grief, both about this one incident and then about how it gets cheapened in the barracks because he's taken her picture and they put it up on the barracks wall and people are using it to find release late at night in the barracks. And the last verse of the song shifts perspective. So we're not really sure. By the end of the song, we know that he's died, but maybe she's died too. We're not really sure. Anyway, it's ambiguous, but it's kind of tantalizingly ambiguous. And the song is full of grief, both for this missed connection in the romantic sense, but also for just the whole idea of war and how war just robs people of their dignity, their humanity, the possibility of happiness. And I've always just been in love with this song. And I've always thought one measure of a great song is to see, you know, how many people cover it. And this does sport some really nice covers. I think this record is full of songs that more country people should sing. And Sleep of the Just deserves to be like a great classic of the people sing. When you try singing it yourself, you understand how difficult a song this is to put across. It's a major challenge for any vocalist. And the production and the singing on the song is absolutely beautiful. So on so many levels, I just admire this song so much. It's a way of taking American country western and recasting it as like an ode, as a headstone for the World War II experience of British people. I think a lot of Americans miss the British, the war story there. But anyway, I just think it's just a major, major feat. And it stands with any of the great songs you want to mention. Sleep of the Just, wonderful song.
So musically, we've got Mitchell Froom playing a piano, fed through a Leslie Cabinet, Jerry Scheff on bass, and Jim Keltner on drums and percussion. It's released in February 1986 on King of America. And would I be right in saying this would have been around the period when you're really making headway with your first book, which is Tell Me Why, a brilliant commentary on the Beatles music. And I was telling you before we started recording that when I was getting into the Beatles as a kid in the 90s, Tell Me Why was like the definitive book for me because it was the one that kind of moved away from biography and John and Paul and Yoko and all of that, and it actually got stuck into the music.
Yeah, so you're right. So I sold that book in the spring of 1985. So I would have been writing, yes. So I remember reading reviews of and writing my review of King of America in 1986. I had moved to New York and I was working on Tell Me Why. So that's exactly right. Very interesting to think about that overlap. But yes, I remember listening to King of America work on that book and The Replacements, Tim. Those were my two big records. Oh, also, Chris Stamey's Instant Excitement, a wonderful EP that's lost to history. Instant Excitement. Nobody remembers that record. Big record for me.
Right. I think one of the things that's difficult to imagine in the 2023 perspective is that when you were writing that book, lots of the knowledge and the information that we now take for granted, I guess, was still unknown at that point, even down to, you know, basic facts about, you know, studio sessions or whatever it might be. That hadn't yet been established in sort of
right.
facts, really.
Right. So the timetable is, yeah, I wish I had had Lewis's the recording sessions yes. when I wrote Tell Me Why, because there's some basic things that I get wrong in the opening pages of Tell Me Why, like I say, Dear Prudence is some of Ringo Starr's greatest drumming. And now we know that's Paul McCartney playing the drums on that session. But I do think that what McCartney does on that track is kind of ingenious, which is he does a very, very solid Ringo Starr imitation on the drums. For years, we assumed that was Ringo Starr. And nobody would, you know, if we didn't know any differently, we would still say, oh, it's one of Starr's great moments. That solo at the end of Dear Prudence in the final verse, where he just cuts all of the energy that song just manifests in those wonderful fills. And it's McCartney. I mean, and McCartney is kind of, you know, like, what do you do with this guy? He's such a virtuoso. It's just maddening. It's just maddening. You just, you know, nobody should be that talented. Nobody. Right, you get Prince is the only guy who gets to be that talented. Actually, McCartney comes first. You know, McCartney's the white prince. There is an anachronism for you. we did not have a lot of these details, and my book came out right at the same moment that Albert Goldman's book did, and it was meant to be like a corrective. It was meant to like preempt Albert Goldman. Of course, Albert Goldman made a huge noise, and everyone covered Goldman and not Tell Me Why, and. It was the same old, right? People are going to go for the trashy, tawdry thread in the Beatles and not the musical thread. But, you know, Tell Me Why has been in print ever since. So that makes me very, very proud. As a Yank, as an American who understands how Brits feel about their Beatles, I feel very honored that British people like this book. It was a book that just burned a hole in me in my whole young life, right? So it was a book that just I couldn't stop. It just poured out of me. And I worked very, very hard on it. And it was really difficult. I was a piano player who was turning himself into a writer by that point. And writing a book's really, really hard. Like it takes a lot of rewrites to make a book work. And that's what I got schooled in early on. And I'm really, you know, it was really worth it. It was worth all of the sweat that I poured into it. And I'm just so glad to hear from people that it holds up. It means a lot to me. Thank you so much for saying that.
No, thank you for all of your work on it. It was an important reference point and remains so. But listen, while we're talking about the Beatles, that brings us neatly onto another song that you almost picked for the playlist from this decade and this fabulous collaboration between McCartney and Costello. And you almost went for one of those songs. And in fact, in keeping with Sleep of the Just, another song with a war theme, actually, which was one of the great lost songs, if we can call it that, because it was never released formally on an album. Tommy's Coming Home.
A one, two. She was counting out the window of an outbound train, all the poles of the telegraph, and the rock-a-bye rhythm in the song of the rails couldn't make the sleeper laugh. Down, 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 so
this is a tricky subject because you get Costello and McCartney deciding to write together. And obviously Costello is a huge Beatle fan. That's got to be a difficult, there's got to be a lot of anxiety around that working with Paul McCartney. And McCartney is, you know, sort of setting himself up for the comment, which does come out of these sessions, which is, yeah, you should collaborate more. Like you're better when you're working with someone. And, you know, so I have to admire both of their abilities to just sort of get sit down and just knock out these sessions. I really love this two acoustic guitars and very, very carefully worked out vocal harmonies. The vocal harmony alone is one of the key reasons I love this track, because it's very you sort of hate to say it, but it's very Beatlesque, right? The intricacy of when they're in unison and when they're in harmony, it's very reminiscent of like She Loves You or From Me to You or If I Fell, right? There's that very canny distinction between unison singing and harmony singing. And the harmonies themselves are very, very unpredictable and just have this great sense of rightness. Like when they catch the interval together, you know, oh, that's perfect. Even though it's totally unexpected, I wouldn't have expected that lower harmony to go there, but it just lands just perfectly. I don't know. It's a very, very high point for both of them, this song. It's a war song. I just listened to it again the other day. I haven't even parsed it yet. I've never written about this song. I couldn't tell you what the plot of the song is. I love the melody of this song so much. I listen to this song at least as much as I listen to any other song by Elvis or Paul McCartney. I think it's a really interesting, rare meeting of minds that's able to pull off something like this. I think it's very special. I think it sits both within each of their catalogs very persuasively and sits outside both of their catalogs in this very interesting way. You know, in a funny kind of way, it's more a song you could imagine Elvis writing on his own than McCartney. So it makes you wonder if it's a song Elvis brought in and McCartney helped him with it. But, you know, McCartney's very unpredictable in certain ways. Like, you know, you'll think that and then you'll get helter skelter, right? So I don't really know. The song has just such a wonderful mystique about it. It's like, I don't want to know. I just want to listen to it and sink into its bath of just tremendous musicality and intelligence. I really don't know what to say about the song, except it's just one of my favorites from both of them.
This is Dangerous Amusements, a show with a taste of decay and the scent of defeat.
In 1990, Elvis Costello headed to Barbados for a series of recording sessions with a bunch of A-list musicians. They weren't recording new Costello numbers. Instead, they were cutting performances of old songs written by other artists. As Elvis put it, recording some of my favourite songs with some of my favourite musicians. The players who joined Elvis at Blue Wave Studios included James Burton, Mark Rebo, Jim Keltner, and the attraction Pete Thomas. The songs they tackled included tracks written by Jesse Winchester, Bob Dylan, and Ray Davies. Named after a grocery store on the road to Blue Wave and co-produced by Kevin Killen, Kojak Variety was kept on ice until its release in May 1995. And it's from this record that you've plucked your selection for the playlist from the 1990s.
You push me when I'm falling, and then you put me down. I guess I missed my calling. I should have been a clown. How much more? How much more can I stand? You're boiling water on a drowning man.
This is Pouring Water on a Drowning Man, originally written by Drew Baker and Danny McCormick.
I love this. This is one of the examples of where Elvis introduced me to the song. And the song is just a perfect, perfect song about heartbreak. And so there's lots of things to say about Elvis as a cover artist. I've often thought that one of the better barometers or yardsticks you can use on a major artist is how differently do we think about them just through their covers, right? How do their covers distinguish them? What do their covers tell us about their view of history, the influence of history on their writing, and which songwriters they prize? And with Costello, obviously, it's very omnivorous, right? He's got one foot in R&B and another foot in country and Western. And this R&B record, you know, is sort of like a cousin to Almost Blue, right? It's somewhere near a decade later than Almost Blue, and it's his take on these are some of my favorite R&B recordings. So one of the parlor games you play with this record is, okay, this is really fun because it sounds like a song Elvis Costello could have written.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just very in the pocket that way. And you see that Elvis has learned so much from these R&B songsmiths. The other thing is, okay, so which source is he referencing in his version of the record, right? And I think most people have talked about James Carr. And James Carr has a fantastic version of this song. But I couldn't tell you who comes first. But I listened to Otis Clay the other day. And Otis Clay for me steals the show. Otis Clay for me is like, he's the guy. I wish we could have Otis Clay singing Get Happy. That would be my ideal record.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, pouring water on a drowning man. What a great image. What a colossal image. It's almost like that's the hyperbole that most of R&B and most of country music has been reaching towards all of this time, right? It's like that's how it feels. And I just love how, you know, what Elvis did for me was he gave me really great portals into both of those catalogs. And he also showed me how similar both of those catalogs are, right? So you're not supposed to, I mean, it's a cliche and a simplification to say, well, yeah, the major themes of both R&B and country music, the major theme is monogamy, right? So it's, let's either get with monogamy or let's sing about how painful non-monogamy can be. And yet there is a truth to that, right? But what you want to then, what he leads you to is, there's this really wonderful way in which R&B is vastly different than country and Western, and not just in the obvious sort of sense of like electric, maybe some faster tempos, maybe more aggressive vocal treatment, all of that stuff. But there's a way in which country and Western really dives deep into self-pity and is sort of like bathing in self-pity in a kind of luxuriant and what's the word I want? An inoffensive way, a kind of a way that's pleasurable, a way that where falling into self-pity actually feels right and good. And like, you know, what people are coaching you to get out of self-pity is that it can be a very enjoyable space. But R&B actually has nothing. Well, it renounces self-pity. R&B is proud. R&B is completely the opposite of that. R&B is, I survived this pain. I march through this pain. I take this pain as a badge. I'm going to go into the next relationship with new fortitude, new clarity, new direction, new purpose, and I will be strengthened by this pain that I'm walking through. And it's those twin attitudes that you can hear all through, you know, many, many Elvis Costello songs, and it's something that he taught me about both of those genres that I treasure.
That is Tear Off Your Own Head, It's a Doll Revolution, and that is the song that you're putting on the playlist from the 2000s, Tim, and that was originally released on the 2002 album When I Was Cruel.
Right, so help me out here. Does Elvis release it first, or do the Bangles release it first?
Yeah, Elvis first, and then the Bangles.
So I listen to them both. You know, this is one where I have a hard time picking. You know, I really love the Bangles version, but his rendition has some really peculiar and, you know, fun. I'd say he errs on the side of the quirky production tricks. Fine. You know, I give him a waiver on this one. Like sometimes those production tricks I find distracting and a little too fussy. And this one I give him, it's a quirky enough song. I think it suits the material. But I would hate to have to choose between Susanna Hoffs singing this and Elvis Costello. Yeah. I just think the Bangles is just sort of terrific. And again, Tear Off Your Own Head. You know, it's like, that song should have been the closing of Barbie. I mean, you know, and Greta Gerwig is supposed to be this big alt rock fan. It's like, no, Tear Off Your Own Head. That is Barbie. That should have been the opening of Barbie or the end of Barbie. That should definitely have been on the Barbie soundtrack. That's the Barbie movie before the movie even gets started. Wonderful, wonderful, funny, funny song. Yes, the other song that he writes with someone else and they cover it first before he covers it is Till Tuesday's Other End of the Telescope. it's worth mentioning. It's like he does sort of co-write that with Amy Mann, and I fell in love with Till Tuesday's version. But I almost chose Other End of the Telescope from Elvis's version because I really love Elvis's version of that song too.
Yeah.
So, wonderful collaborator, wonderful. I mean, this is another way in which he expresses his affection for all of rock and roll and all of pop, is writing songs for other people. And his partnerships with Burt Bacharach and David Bartholomew. No, it's not Bartholomew. Alan Toussaint. What am I saying? David Bartholomew. Yeah.
To be fair to you, he covered Dave Bartholomew, so you've not just plucked it from nowhere.
All right, good. Which Bartholomew song does he do?
He did The Monkey, and then he wrote his own version of it as well, Monkey to Man, a couple of years later.
Oh, I've got to go chase that down. So you'll see, you can tell that I'm sort of losing the thread, right? As we go look further into his career, he was really important to me early on. About the time of Tear Off Your Own Head, I'm thinking, I really sort of like it when he's writing more for other people. I'm sort of like he's not as compelling to me in this latter half of his career. And, you know, that's ironic because part of that is because he's led me deep into music history and all these other people, right? The other part of that is very few people have figured out how to sustain quality and consistency over so many decades. They really have. And his unevenness, in my mind, is completely forgivable, right? And I like weak records of his that other people hate. Like, I really like Punch the Clock. I really like Goodbye, Cruel World. I understand they're flawed, but I take those records over Brutal Youth. I mean, I know it's heresy to say that. I get in trouble when I talk like that, but I'm a critic. I sort of feel like, I have the courage of my convictions, right? So the later records just are not as compelling to me. I admire them. I respect them. For me, they're just a tad too self-conscious, a bit too schoolmarmish. Like, oh, here's all of this. Here, now I have all of this craft here. I'm going to dazzle you with craft. But I admire the impulse, right? I have great respect for his omnivorousness, for his wide range in taste and listening.
I love you more than she ever will. But the only way she can get a man is still. I don't know if I should tell you this or not. She's got everything it takes to take everything you've got.
So we've talked about Elvis writing songs for other people. The next song that you've chosen, come from the 2010s, is the opposite. This is him making a guest appearance on somebody else's song. This is Elvis turning up on the Loretta Lynn number, Everything It Takes.
So you got to just love Loretta Lynn, how great she sounds so late into her career. I mean, this is the thing, right? Country people, they have figured out how to sustain these very, very long careers, right? Rock and roll is still learning how to do that, I'd say.
Yeah.
I'd say if you had one of those data sheets, you know, you could trace some of the great country careers and you could say higher moments of consistency and through their longevity than many, many rock and rollers, right? I think rock and roll just sets up its own, because it starts as youth music, maybe, right? Although people have stopped thinking about rock and roll as strictly youth music, right? We're past that. So how to put together a long career? I'm really glad you let me choose this song because it's a Loretta Lynn song. Although the reason I chose it is that it's very easy to imagine Elvis Costello writing this song, right? The wordplay, she's cold as ice, but you think she's really hot. And I mean, you know, just like this wonderful, it's like she's trying to write an Elvis Costello song. And it's actually very successful. It works really well. So I like that. I like thinking that this is an imaginary song that Elvis could have written for Loretta Lynn, might have written for Loretta Lynn. And then the other thing I love about it is that his contribution is, he's just pure backup. Like, he doesn't even sing a verse of this song. It's all Loretta Lynn. The spotlight is all on her. And he's just there. I mean, why is he there? Because he just adores Loretta Lynn. And because he is, you know, kneeling at the altar of country music once again and saying, I learned so much from this person. I would die to be on one of her records. I feel so lucky to be on one of her records. So it's a tribute and a sign of respect. And I just love all of the ways that respect gets reflected on this recording.
Yeah, it's such an understated contribution, isn't it?
Right, exactly.
It's a bit like Elvis does when he has Jenny Lewis on Momofuku or Nicole Atkins on The Boy Named Iv. It's not, you know, big lights saying featuring Elvis Costello. It's like, no, he's just the voice in the background.
Exactly, right? Understatement is underrated. It's totally underrated, right?
Yes.
And for someone who I criticize for being overtly pretentious in certain gestures, right? Part of the reason I criticize him for that is because he's able to do an understated gesture like this, right? He knows how to do it. For me, this far outshines a project like the Juliet Letters. Far outshines it because it's respectful. It's consistent with the style. It shows like a deep understanding of the genre and its principles and its values. So yeah, I'm really glad you let me choose this because it's not an Elvis Costello song. But it is of a parcel with his work in the cover arena, right? We would call this like maybe a partial cover, a fifth of a cover, maybe. I don't know what you'd say.
Yeah. Well, it maintains that relationship with Loretta Lynn as well. They'd previously written Pardon Me, Madam, My Name is Eve from Momofuku, and I Felt the Chill Before the Winter Came, which was released on Secret Profane and Sugarcane. She also wrote I'm a Honky Tonk Girl, which Costello recorded with the Attractions during the Almost Blue sessions.
Of course. There's that connection that I had forgotten about. Yes, totally. Great. I'm so glad you brought that up. Very good.
Yeah, and then this was released as a single in January 16, and then on the album Full Circle, which came out in March of that year, and which was nominated for a Grammy for the Best Country Album. And now let's move on. We've got one more to go, and this is from another album that was nominated for a Grammy. We're coming right up to date with a track from 2022's The Boy Named Iv. So that's the last song choice, this one coming from the 2020s. It's the opening track to The Boy Named Iv. It's Farewell OK.
Yeah, so a deep affection for his Highway 61 side, his rock and roll as an exercise in outre non sequiturs. You know, you don't know where the top is, you don't know where the bottom is. The middle is very difficult to identify. Just a great caterwauling streak through a wonderful maze of noise. And this really reminds me of, when Blood and Chocolate came out. So we were also dazzled by King of America that, you know, the move after King of America, we knew was going to be very decisive. Like what? So once you establish, it's like Sgt. Pepper. Once you do that, what's your next move? Like, how do you follow? Right. And King of America really had a certain stature and a new kind of certain, you know, it was a new direction, and he followed it with Blood and Chocolate, which, you know, I had this big argument with my dear friend Jimmy Gutterman, who argued that it was a fallback record. You know, it just wasn't advancing all of the forward motion that he was getting from King of America, and that it was sort of a cop out. And I just don't hear cop out on Blood and Chocolate. And I think to start the follow up record, the King of America, with Uncomplicated, I just think it's really genius. I think it's wonderful. And it's just a big sprawling mess of a record. And some wonderful sideshows like Poor Napoleon, still one of my favorite. I just love Poor Napoleon. What a great B-side of a track. What a great lost faraway track that nobody ever mentions anymore. So that record has a lot of really wonderful sweet spots for me. And when I heard this song on the 2022 record, I thought, aha, that sounds a lot like the Blood and Chocolate move, right? Now, as I'm praising that, you have to sort of say, well, it's qualified praise, right? Because what he's doing there is he's echoing the Blood and Chocolate move. So it's not a new move, right? It's actually like this is an old move from him, but he still has a lot. You know, it's part of the problem with summarizing Costello's career is that he will surprise you. Right? He still has a lot in his back pocket that he can pull out and say, oh, yeah, you thought I was done, but I'm not done with this string. You know, there's still this. And he's like Dylan in this way. Dylan still surprises me. And Costello, he has that same quality. And this track really leapt out at me. It's like, well, this is as strong a piece of rock and roll as anything on Blood and Chocolate. I have to really say, well, I need to reassess again. I can't simply write Elvis Costello off, even if I don't know. The first half of the career for me is still the more cherished piece of the career. So, yeah, I like the way he keeps me jumping. He keeps me questioning. He keeps pulling out surprises. That to me is incredibly impressive. Especially, we're talking about this is the sixth decade. It's the song for the sixth decade. Yeah, I mean, you know, I hope to be as surprising in my sixth and seventh decades as he is. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, this track was released initially for a short period on YouTube on New Year's Eve before being withdrawn and then officially released as a single in 21 before opening the album The Boy Named Iv in January 2022. Of course, it was recorded remotely during the pandemic, and Elvis said, you have a choice between hunkering down and doing mopey, way-faced ballads about isolation, or you can kick a hole in the box you're in. And as soon as you get that opening to Farewell OK, you know which option he's chosen, don't you?
Totally, right? I love that quote. I hadn't seen that quote. Yeah, and that, you know, that turns out to be a pretty good answer on a lot of different levels, not just creativity, right? But sometimes the best way to bang through a piece of writing you're having trouble with is to like break the box that you're sitting in. Yes, excellent, excellent advice on many different levels. And you can hear it. You can hear it in the record. I really love to hear Pete Thomas's progression as a drummer. I mean, to me, he's playing better than ever. I would like to hear Pete Thomas's drumming from this record on Get Happy. That's what I'd like to hear. Get Happy, it feels like it's all pointed in the right direction. This record has just a lot more authority in the playing. I have to say I was knocked sideways by this track on this record because it was like, oh, he could still do it. And that, you know, I don't know, I feel a little bit humbled by that.
Yeah, I thought you changed, got a little humble. That's one of the lines from Farewell OK. So.
Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. Well, they're fantastic songs you've picked out for us, Tim. Thank you for doing that. And I know time is about to beat us here, but if we could just sort of summarize it, if you could hear anything now from Elvis Costello in his next move, what would you like to hear him do most?
Well, you know, I guess I'd like to follow through on the cover streak and the R&B and the country and Western. You know, I think it'd be very interesting for him to go back and cover some of his own records.
Okay.
So we hear him live, right? You've got a few live records. I think the King of America stuff live with those musicians was an extraordinary. I didn't get to see it, but you know, the boots are extraordinary. I'd love to hear him do like Get Happy with a different crew and maybe revising some of those songs and turning them into country songs. Taking some of the country songs from King of America and doing them as R&B songs.
I'd like
to hear his wisdom, which you can hear on that last track we played. I'd like to hear his combined experience of all of his music put into rethinking some of the songs and coming at them from different angles. I think it would be extraordinary to hear Get Happy as an acoustic record, for example. I just think the songcraft is there. It'll stand up, and it'll make us hear all that material in a completely different way. You know, some of the great concerts I've heard him do have been just all acoustic. And I love the way he will transform some of his very familiar material. You know, doing Every Day I Write the Book alone on an acoustic guitar. I mean, it just makes you hear the song differently, right? It's the same song, but it's just like it's got a different set of clothes on. I just love how he does that. I'd love to hear him do like Costello reinterprets his own songs.
Wow, what a great thought to end the conversation on. I'm probably going to spend the rest of the evening pondering that and coming up with what my dream track list would be for him to do. So
yeah, okay, yeah. Well, let's do it. Let's do it. I'll send you my track list in an email, okay?
Yeah, fantastic, fantastic. Oh, Tim, as I say, what a great ending to a terrific conversation. Thank you so much for coming on and going back to teenage me. Thank you so much for all of the work that you put in on those great books in your own back catalogue.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really fun to sit and talk about Costello for an hour.
Thank you, Tim. I actually can't stop thinking now about the track listing of an album. I'd love to hear of Elvis now revisiting some of the earlier songs from in his career. I'd love to know what you think about it. Get in touch. I'm on X, Instagram, and Threads as Dangerous Amusements. My website is dangerousamusements.co.uk. Thanks so much to Tim for coming on. His website, if you want to find out more about his writing, timrileyauthor.com. And he is on Instagram and X as Tim Riley Author. Thanks for listening. If you want to leave us a 5-star rating and review, I would love you to do so wherever you listen to your podcasts. The theme music for Dangerous Amusements is performed by Gary Mulcahy.
Thanks for listening to Dangerous Amusements, sending you our love and vicious kisses.